The world's population is well on its way to doubling, all in the span of a single human's lifetime. The explosive growth of people has gotten the food chain tied up in knots. What has this rush to feed so many mouths really cost us? And will we be dining on doom and gloom by the end of this century? Our guest today is a journalist who's been taking notes on these subjects for more than 20 years. He served as an editor for a trade journal about peanut farming and for the venerated pages of National Geographic, where he's reported on oil exploration in Alaska, the future of New Orleans, the global food crisis, and a cover story on the BP oil spill. He's been all over the world on assignment. These places come together in his new book, The End of Plenty, The Race to Feed a Crowded World. Joel K. Bourne Jr. is on the line with us now. We'd like to welcome Joel to the show.
Hey, Emily. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. We're honored you could be here. Now, Joel, you began on your family's farm. Could you tell us where that is?
Sure. It's in eastern North Carolina. I grew up in a small town called Tarboro, and my grandfather had a farm in the county that was sort of my playground. I worked there as a kid and hunted and fished there most of my life. And at that time, I thought a farmer was all I wanted to be. That was the penultimate existence for me. So I only applied to one college, NC State, and enrolled in the ag school in 1981.
So you didn't consider farming boring or unglamorous. What about your friends at school?
Well, I was in the ag program, so everybody around me was a farm kid who loved it as much as I did. But it wasn't later until I started working in journalism and started moving to the cities and circulating in much more urban environments that I realized that most people didn't really have a clue as to how their food got to them or how it was grown or the stresses that were caused on the agricultural landscape, and also what the environmental impact of our food production system was causing. So, when people would ask me what my degree was, and I would say agronomy, their eyes would glaze over and they'd just sort of wander off. It's not a very exciting subject for most people in the United States.
Well, we certainly don't want our listeners to glaze over and walk off, but it might be important at this juncture to understand what is agronomy. Have you figured out how to tell people in a way that that keeps their interest?
Well, it's the art and science of feeding the planet, you know, and for me, it's fascinating. I mean, our first five presidents were all farmers. Thomas Jefferson was probably the most enthusiastic farmer of them all and risked his life to smuggle varieties of rice seeds out of Italy at a time when such crimes were punishable by death. You know, he had them sewn into the hem of his cloak. And of course, today we tend to take our food for granted. We live in the United States, where probably the most productive food producing nation on the planet. So we are blessed with plenty. But in many other parts of the world, like when I travel to Latin America and I tell them, I have a degree, I'm an agronomista, they're very impressed, and they know exactly what that is.
Really? So when you travel, people outside the United States know what agronomy is and realize how important it is.
Oh, sure. I went on a Rotary student exchange back in the 80s, and I had just graduated from ag school, but I was also working as a journalist at the time. And when I told them I was a periodista, a journalist, they were like, yeah, so what? We shoot three or four of those guys every day. But when I said, well, I'm also an agronomista, and they went, oh, agronomista, see, very good, very good. Bueno. And of course, this was because during the 1950s and 60s, much of Latin America was very hungry and not getting the nutrition they needed. And thanks to the Green Revolution, Norman Borlaug, and the whole story there, they were able to radically increase their food production to the point where they were pretty much self-sufficient in food grains. And that was one of the great great strides in food production in our recent history.
Now, Joel Bourne, you've had the opportunity to travel the world as a writer for National Geographic. You just said of the United States that we are blessed with plenty. Your new book is called The End of Plenty, The Race to Feed a Crowded World. Where is this ending coming? Is this a global situation, or are we talking specifically about the United States?
Well, we're all going to feel it. I think both rich countries and poor. And essentially, when I did the story on the global food crisis back in 2008, 2009, what we discovered was that our demand is gradually but steadily outstripping our supply. So, and what that means is, you know, we've got food demand comes from a couple of different places. The primary place, of course, is population growth. And we've got 80, as you mentioned in your intro, we've got 80 million more people to feed every year. The UN just came out with its population projections for 2050 and 2100. And now they do this every 2 years, and each one has steadily gone up. So now we're looking at 9.7 billion by 2050 and 11.2 billion by the end of the century, which is phenomenal. So when the agricultural researchers looked at this, they said, wow, this is incredible. The demand from that is significant, but also we're having people earn more money. So in the developing world, like China and India, the middle class is booming. It's getting larger. And the first thing people who once ate very low on the food chain do when they get money is they tend to eat things that are higher on the food chain. So in India, it's fruits and vegetables and dairy, lots of dairy. And in China, it's meat. So China's per capita meat consumption has doubled in the last decade. And for them, it's hogs. And that's sort of a multiplier for grain, right? Because it takes five times the amount of calories to get the same amount back from pork as it does from just eating the grain itself. 10 times when you talk about beef, grain-fed beef. So thanks to this growing income, as well as the growing population, scientists now say we need to double our grain production by 2050, which is extremely difficult to do. One plant breeder at Purdue likes to say we're going to have to learn to grow more food in the next 35 years than we have in the last 10,000. So it's an enormous challenge.
And you just mentioned the different different food products that are in demand more in the developing world. Are these things that are necessarily produced in the countries where they're wanted?
No, they're not, and that's the key. One of the other things that was really surprising is that, you know, there are 50,000 edible plants on Earth, right? Only three, wheat, rice, and corn, contribute to 80 to 90% of all the calories consumed, either directly or indirectly through animal feed. And that's just staggering. Some of the anthropologists say, you know, we went from being hunters and gatherers to canaries because we now eat so much grain. And that has an enormous effect on how we feed the planet.
Well, a lot to talk about here with Joel Caborn Jr., the author of The End of Plenty, The Race to Feed a Crowded World. It's out in hardback now. Joel is a longtime writer for National Geographic and our guest today on the Jefferson Exchange. I'm your host, and for Jeffrey Riley, my name is Emily Curitan, also the producer of this show. We'll be back with Joel Caborn and your phone calls and emails on the flip side of a very short break. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Joel Caborn, the author of The End of Plenty, The Race to Feed a Crowded World. We're talking about food, farming, population growth, and a whole lot of other very big issues. We'd love to get your input as well. That phone number, 800-838-3760, or email us, jx@jeffnet.org. Now, Joel, you kind of just rocked my world a little bit. You said that of 50,000 edible plants, only three crops account for the vast majority of calories that humans consume. Can you elaborate more on how we got there?
Sure. Well, basically, because of this great run-up in agricultural production that happened during the 50s and 60s, it allowed this enormous population growth that occurred during the boom. So global population has doubled since 1960, right? But because we grew so much grain with they're not new anymore, but they're, you know, these sort of chemical-intensive monocultures of staple grain crops, that amount of grain virtually tripled. So it kept food prices very low, and it enabled, in some cases, it enabled places in Asia to flourish, maybe even building up that industrial economy that they're now doing quite so well in now. But it's bizarre. So here we have three crops, and one, rice alone, provides the bulk of the calories for half the planet. Now, part of the problem is that great run-up in food production during the Green Revolution has plateaued. So we were increasing yields year after year. But right around 2000, those yields started to flatten off. And so we haven't seen yield growth in the major wheat or rice-producing countries in almost a decade.
What caused the flattening off of those yields?
Well, we kind of took our eye off the ball. Norman Borlaug, who was sort of considered the father of this movement, won the Nobel Peace Prize for his work in 1970. And he even said then, we've got 30 years to figure this out. This basically gives us 30 years of breathing room before the population is going to catch up with us, and we're going to be right back where we started in the 1950s when a third of the world's population was hungry. Right now, it's about 12 to 14%. So, but it's, once again, you know, on the rise because these yield growths, we basically stopped investing in basic agricultural research. During the 80s and 90s, there was so much grain. It was a glut. Prices were so low that plant breeders lost interest. And so, especially in wheat and rice. So we just haven't invested in keeping those yields going. And now some biologists and plant breeders are thinking, well, maybe we've hit their yield cap. Maybe we've gone as far as we can go with these type of plants, and we can go no further. And that is really scary, because the only other way you increase production, if you don't increase yield, is by taking down more forests, which we really, really don't want to do.
Yeah, and we are focusing a bit on the doom and gloom side of this in this part of the hour. We will take a turn down the hour on a more hopeful note. But first, you just mentioned the year 2000 as sort of a benchmark for when we stopped being able to increase the yield on the main crops of our globalized food system. Can you talk about more of what happened at the turn of the 21st century that made it so ending world hunger became more complicated than just producing more food?
Sure. Well, the other big thing that occurred at the turn of the century that had an enormous impact on food supply was biofuels. So in the United States, we had this huge run-up that was supported by the government. We had federal mandates to produce this stuff. And, you know, right now we take 40% of our corn crop and turn it into ethanol, which we then pour into our gasoline supply. And Europe did it with biodiesel, where they've now got about 10% of their arable land planted in sunflower and rapeseed and soybeans that they turn into biodiesel. We're using the same sort of government incentives. So basically, they're just taking land out of production and also increasing prices of these things by increasing demand without making food more available to anyone. So the biofuel revolution, the decade, is one of the enormous factors that caused the demand to increase and caused prices to rise. So to give you some perspective, since the 1970s, we typically produce more of these three grains than we use in any given year. So in the 1970s, there were 3 years that we didn't quite produce as much as we use. In the 80s, it was about four. In the 90s, it was back down to three. But since the 2000s, we've used, eaten, or consumed, or turned into biofuel more of these grains than we've produced in eight of the first 12 years of the century, drawing down our global stockpiles to some of the lowest levels since the 70s. So this is, again, one of those things that makes prices extremely volatile and makes everyone very worried about how people are going to feed themselves, especially the people, you know, the half the world who lives on $2 a day and spends 50 to 70% of their money on food.
So, again, the question of how world hunger, it gets complicated. It sounds like what we're growing, it's not all going towards food, and that the factors, supply and demand, gets pretty complicated. We have a caller on the line who has a question. Tina Joe in the Applegate has been waiting. I'd like to go to her now. Tina Joe, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. So yeah. I'm curious. I'm so glad to hear you addressing questions of just kind of inequity and, you know, meat production and gas and the many things that we do use the soil for, especially the meat eating. I feel like I know so many activists who just can't look at that when they love their bacon too much or something. But I guess I'm curious, it's been a long time since I've been staying current with the research about how much food actually goes to waste in terms of, you know, grain silos just filled with food that's rotting when people are starving, and also issues such as, you know, the huge famine in Ethiopia. At that same time, they were exporting strawberries and roses. you know, so just the question of what's grown for who and under whose mandate is, I think, really important. And I wonder if your book addresses that.
Thank you, Tina.
Oh, Tina, I hit on a very important point. Right now, we currently waste 30% of all the food we grow. And if you talk about vegetables and meat, which are the most energy and water intensive, it's as much as 50%. Now, in the developed countries like the United States, most of that is post-consumer, right? So we buy too much at the grocery store, we could eat too much in the restaurant, and it all goes into the bin. In the developing world, they have a problem with storage. So they don't have the grain bins that can keep the corn dry. They don't have the refrigeration like we do. And a lot of the waste is pre-farm gate. So their crops are rotting in the fields. They also have very poor infrastructure in places like Sub-Saharan Africa or South Asia, where it's very difficult to get the crops to market in a timely manner. So food waste is one of the low-hanging fruits. When we talk about solution, reducing the amount of food we waste is just a no-brainer. And it could literally open up 30% of the food that we now grow and save all that water and all that energy that's used to produce it. Now, Tina's other point about Ethiopia exporting strawberries while people in the streets were starving is one of these unbelievable phenomenons. And I write about this and use as an example the country of Haiti, which used to be self-sufficient in rice during the 1980s. But when President Bill Clinton brought President Aristide back into power on the back of a U.S. warship, one of the conditions that he asked for was for Aristide to drop his trade barriers against American rice, which he did. And immediately Haiti was flooded with, they called it Miami rice, this enormously cheap rice in the United States, which is subsidized to the hill. We only have about three states that grow rice, including California, as well as Arkansas. They're heavily subsidized, and they completely wiped out rice production in Haiti. The rice farmers there just couldn't afford to compete. So what happened in 2008, when the price of the world grain price of rice rose fivefold, Haiti was left starving. They had no money to buy rice on the open market. You know, and when I was interviewing people with USAID, the big aid agency for the United States, they were defending this policy while, you know, moms were making cookies made of lard and dirt to feed their children. It was just incredible. And even Bill Clinton, who is now a, you know, UN envoy to Haiti, has apologized for that policy, for taking away Haiti's ability to grow a staple crop. And he says it has not worked there. It has not worked anywhere it's tried, this whole globalization thing where you take away a country's capacity to feed itself.
Yeah, food as a political weapon seems to figure prominently in your book. You just mentioned a few examples. Could you talk some more about when that's happening? And is that new to population growth, or has food always been used as a political weapon?
You know, food has been used as a, believe it or not, food has been used as a political weapon since, you know, the Romans took over Egypt and used it as their grain basket, you know, so they could expand their empire. Now, in more recent history, we have used food, we have sort of dangled food aid to Europe after World War II to sort of stave off the Bolshevists, you know, back then. We've also used food aid to entice India away from the Communist Party back in the 1960s and 70s. Lyndon Johnson was, ruthless when it came to that. He would trickle aid to India just enough to keep them from starving, just so they wouldn't make good with the Soviet Union or make friends with them. So it was, yes, food is always a very political use, especially in terms of trade. I write about it again in a substance in a case in Africa, where a few years ago they had a major drought in the southern tip of Africa, and suddenly, you know, the U.S. leapt into action, sent the World Food Program a bunch of corn and soybeans, and when it got there, it turned out the bulk of it were GMOs, which the African countries had not approved for coming in. And there was a huge controversy over whether or not, you know, the United States government were trying to break down this barrier against GMOs that is now in pretty much in place in much of Africa. So yes.
We're talking about things like food being used to gain political leverage, people starving as trucks loaded with exported strawberries, perhaps glistening strawberries, roll by. This brings me back to a more theoretical question. In your book, The End of Plenty, The Race to Feed a Crowded World, there's a couple of theories about what causes famine and hunger, ideas that focus on inevitability of resource exhaustion and also population growth. And then they tend to frame human ingenuity as a counteracting force to that. But it appears science has not always been an opposing force to an environmental destruction. How have we worked against ourselves in recent decades?
Well, this is one of the things that was revealing to me in the story, is that we are literally farming ourselves out of food. By the way, we currently produce food in the United States and around the world. The Green Revolution, in our whole entire food system, this chemical-intensive, energy-intensive food system that we've developed that's now feeding the bulk of the planet, is also the third, the source of third largest emissions, global emissions that we're having to deal with now in climate change. And many studies that are looking at climate change and its impact on food production are incredibly scary. One that I cite in the book is from the Royal Society in London that says that if we allow, if we continue on the path we're on and get to a 4 degree centigrade increase in global average temperatures, then half of our agricultural land may be unsuitable for farming by centuries end. And that's when population gets to 11.2 billion. And no one wants to foresee that kind of future, where half the world can't feed itself because its land is no longer able to grow crops. So the current way we do things has to change. It just has to change. There's no way about it. We need to come up with a new type of agriculture that sequesters carbon, that, creates nutrient food for everyone. And also a new system in which everyone is able to afford this food. So when you talk about the Bengal famine, like I did in one of my chapters, one of the things that Amartya Sen, the great economist and Nobel Prize laureate, taught us was that it's not just the amount of food, and we currently grow enough food to feed 9 billion people, but the vast majority of the people can't afford to be fed. Most of that food is grown a world away from the people who need it most. So distribution is always tricky. You don't want to dump crops on other countries because that hurts their farmers. But you also, it's just chronically unfair that some countries are just more agriculturally blessed than others. So the goal is to help other countries, increase their food production ability by helping their farmers.
Joel, I want to take a call now from Ralph in Mendocino. He's been waiting on the line with a question. Ralph in Mendocino, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. You are on the air.
Yes, thank you very, very much. I'm an meteorist. I would like to do something to improve the condition of the world. I think we can probably accommodate 50 million people on this planet if we treat them like chickens producing eggs. We have to consider the impact of population as a topic, pure and simple. Our opportunity to bring about effective, positive change in the world is diminished by population increase. It's incredible. I can't bring myself to congratulate somebody who anticipates becoming a parent because they're so damn ignorant. It's amazing.
All right, Ralph, thank you for that call. I want to give Joel a chance to respond here. I think Ralph does bring up an interesting point about human population. It brings us to the topic of social inequalities and these what you just described as chronic unfairness. Joel, would you like to respond to Ralph or perhaps run
sure.
with it?
You know, Ralph is touching on a very, very important point, but also one that's extremely sensitive and controversial. Population, including family planning, contraceptives, it's the third rail of development work. Nobody wants to talk about it. Everybody knows how important it is. And yet, the money for the things that would matter most in terms of what Ralph's talking about, reducing this demand. There's no law that says we have to hit 9.7 billion by 2050 or hit 11 billion by the end of the century. In fact, every researcher who's looked at this says if we can just make family planning services and contraception available to all the women that need it and want it, you can reduce fertility rate, the amount of children, people have during their lifetime, to a replacement rate virtually overnight. Now, you can aid yourself by doing that by educating women. That's another thing that I talk about. in the book, which I think is really probably the most important point in there, is that we really need to start a pink revolution. In many of these countries that are seeing enormous population growth still, where women are still having 5 to 7 children during their lifetime, they are virtually enslaved. They don't get to choose how many children they have. This is something that's dominated by their parents or their husband or their mother-in-law. They're not educated. But studies have found that if you simply educate women to at least the 6th grade, and I would prefer through high school, they will have fewer children, and they will also have much greater opportunities in their lives to contribute to their countries, their communities, their farms, their families. It is the best thing we can do for them. It is the best thing they can do for themselves. Now, there are a lot of people like Ralph who see humans as a stain on the planet, and you know, it's very easy to see how people can see that. We've eradicated almost half of our big vertebrate species since 1970 as human population has doubled. But humans are also the solution. You know, I firmly feel like we're going to get ahead of this. We can, you know, we can see the writing on the wall now. There are enough people saying climate change is coming. You know, we've got all these immigration issues going on in Europe right now where people are fleeing violence, but they're also fleeing food insecurity. And in order to make demand and supply meet, you can have to reduce demand some way. And helping decrease population growth is one major way we can do that.
We're talking with Joel K. Bourne, Jr., the author of The End of Plenty, The Race to Feed a Crowded World. He's a longtime writer for National Geographic. The book is out now. You're listening to The Jefferson Exchange, and I'm Emily Curitan in for Jeffrey Riley today. We've got a lot to talk about. We've really been doom and glooming it here for the first part of the hour. I'd like to turn to possible solutions right on the other side of a very short break. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. We've been talking about The Race to Feed a Crowded World. That's the subtitle of Joel K. Bourne's newest book, The End of Plenty. We have calls and emails coming in, and we want to hear from you. Have you chosen to limit your family in light of world population concerns? Do you have ideas about how to make sustainability go beyond window dressing? Give us a call, 800-838-3760, or email us, jx@jeffnet.org. We've actually got an email on deck here from Amy in Ashland. She writes, "Wouldn't vegetarianism solve at least some of the scarcity problem? If we didn't have to feed pigs and cows so much grain, wouldn't there be more food to go around?" Joel, would you like to?
Absolutely. Amy's perfectly right. And, you know, a study in Britain a couple of years ago said that if we feed our family of four, you know, a hamburger dinner, it's almost the equivalent of taking them for a 100-mile ride in their car. So definitely reducing our meat consumption. I don't know if we're going to get everyone to become vegetarians. I think that's going to be a challenge. But if beef and pork prices continue to rise as grain prices rise, then I think you're going to see them becoming much more a treat down the road than a staple of every day. And that's, you know, and honestly, that's a good thing, because right now, you know, a high meat consumption diet is contributing to this obesity epidemic that is going to make half of the U.S. population either have diabetes or pre-diabetes by 2020. And it's going to cost us trillions of dollars in health care costs. It's just absolutely ridiculous and unsustainable. So eating less meat, eating lower on the food web, is by far one of the best things we can do for our health and for the planet. Amy's right on in that regard.
What about habitat destruction, though? That I've heard the flip side of that argument is that you know, growing soybeans in mass and things like that, it doesn't. There's a different cost there. Have you considered that?
Yes, but you know, the vast majority of soybeans on the planet are not grown for human consumption. They're grown to feed pigs, mostly in China. So, you know, pigs, chickens, I mean, soybeans, only in China do we start to see a lot of tofu being produced and consumed and using soybeans directly, which is a good thing because they're fairly healthy and low in fat, have all kinds of good oils in them. But, yes, the soybean revolution that rolled into Latin America in the 90s was largely fueled by the increase in pork consumption in China. So China now has half the world's pigs. They can't afford to grow enough grain to feed both their people and their hogs. And so they import. They become the largest importer of soybeans in the world, mostly from Brazil and Argentina. So, yes, it's sort of right and wrong on that.
Let's take another call here. We've got Cynthia and Talent on the line. Cynthia and Talent, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. You are on the air.
Yeah, thank you. I was just thinking that one of the things that is not often included in discussions about population and how many people the planet can support are, you know, just, I don't know, it's not a popular topic, but I'm going to bring it up anyway, how long we should all be living. Because there was a time when, you know, average lifespan was, what, 75 years. Now people are living to be 95 and older, and there are people who think that, you know, living to be 120 would really be a wonderful thing. But when you think about the number of people on the planet, if we're living longer, then we need to delay when we have children, as well as how many children we have.
Interesting, interesting perspective, Cynthia and Talent. Thank you for calling us. Joel?
I love Cynthia's comment because we're starting to see incredible aging populations. And this is sort of the heart of demography, right? This is looking at how populations change and how that affects our economy, our education, our industry. And we're starting to see that in places like Japan, where people, you know, the average age of Japanese people is getting older and older. They're living extremely long lives. And if they retire at 65, of course, that puts another 40 years burden on, or 30 years burden on their the younger people to support them with social services and medical care and health care and that sort of thing. So I think what we're going to start to see, we're starting to see a rapid aging of places like Russia, places like Japan, China, believe it or not, because of its one-child policy that implemented in the 1970s, will start to see a rapid decline in population by mid-century, as well as a rapid aging. And that's going to have an enormous impact on how the world economy goes, because as we get older, we're less active, we're less productive, well, in terms of, you know, our workforce and our workday. But that's not a bad thing. You know, maybe we'll have a good long life and we'll be less warlike and we'll be less likely to intervene in foreign conflict. So I think as one of the demographers I interviewed for the story says, you know, going into a quiet senescence is not a bad thing as populations in countries go. You know, you can be a quite happy, older, mature country as long as you can get the demographics changes working in your favor.
Joel, I want to switch gears a little bit here. Earlier you said we are literally farming ourselves out of food, a comment that really struck me. And I'd like to talk more about farming itself. We've covered population growth quite a bit with our callers. Another one of the big boogeymen of our time is climate change. Are there farmers out there who are able to somehow take climate change into account and develop practices where they're going to be able to weather that?
Well, sure. And this is one of the books. I've got two chapters in the book where I talk about in the solutions chapters toward the end, where I talk about things like organic agriculture and what kind of contribution it can make to just having better agronomy around the world and not depending on chemicals so much to do it. Because one of the things we've found through studying organic farming over the years is that it not only uses less chemicals, or it also emits less chemicals to the atmosphere. The local watershed. So you don't have the nutrient runoff that you do with conventional agriculture. And you actually, by focusing on soil health and organic matter in the soil, you're actually storing more carbon in the soil. So every farmer in the world can take a page from the organic farmers and work hard to try to incorporate more and more organic matter into their soils to help turn our, you know, all our, 40% of the Earth's dry land into a carbon sequestering type of agriculture that also feeds us as well. So there are many people who are working on this issue. I mentioned one called the system of rice intensification, where it's sort of using this very organic and peasant-based techniques that triples the yield, use half the water, and also sequesters more carbon in the soil. It's just a win-win all around.
So are we seeing innovations come out of these still agrarian societies, or is there a lot of the big money of a globalized food system? Is any of that going towards innovating our way out of this mess?
Well, they're trying. And actually, you know, it's really funny. GMOs have been so controversial in the United States, still are, particularly in your neck of the woods. And, you know, for me, I take a fairly practical view of them. The two big traits that we have now, BT and Roundup resistance, you know, they haven't done all that much damage. They haven't caused all that much harm. They've done a little bit of good in terms of reducing soil runoff in the Midwest and in reducing the amount of more toxic pesticides we use on cotton, particularly in places like India and China. But overall, they haven't really moved the yield ball very far. I liken them to that 80s rock band that had two good hits and then kept playing the same song over and over again. You know, they're not doing what they were hyped to do in the early 80s when they first came on the scene.
Okay, so Monsanto could be like the knack of big ag here.
That's right.
You just mentioned Roundup Ready crops. You're right. That is a real sensitive, hot topic in, I think, globally, but especially here in southern Oregon. Is engineering crops to be resistant to pesticides rather than pests moving in the wrong direction from a soil science perspective?
Yeah, I think it is. And, of course, we're starting to see the blowback with this incredible dependence on Roundup. Right now we've got Roundup-resistant weeds in almost every state. We've got corn rootworms, one of the major corn crop pests, growing resistance to BT. I mean, we've so mismanaged these two traits that they're losing their usefulness very quickly. So, but on the other hand, you know, we're starting to use these techniques, these genetic techniques. It's so cheap now to do gene sequencing that now researchers at land-grant universities are actually able to use these techniques to provide really crops that provide public good. One example I cite in the book is flood-resistant rice that was developed at UC Davis, researchers at UC Davis and the International Rice Research Institute in the Philippines. And they developed a rice. It's not a transgenic because they found an old gene, an old rice cultivar that wasn't doing anything, put it in a very popular rice cultivar, and made it resistant to submergence for almost 2 weeks. Now, after 2 weeks, if it gets dry, it comes right back, yields exactly the same as if it had. And most people think of rice as sort of living in water, and it does, but it really hates to be inundated. And in places where it's flood prone, as sea level starts to rise, those areas are starting to increase. Having rice that can resist floods like that is just an incredible godsend to those farmers. So there are some things we're starting to do that will, I hope, have some benefits down the road.
We have an email here from Jay in Walterville, famous on the exchange for his use of poetic license in his emails. Jay in Walterville writes, "Water is taken for granted or granted to be taken. Ag degrades water, then water degrades all. Environment, humans, and all, qualitatively speaking. Now, add qualitatively the conundrum of wrong crops, less wrong crops in the wrong places, places growing sod seed instead of edible grains, such as the Willamette Valley. An example of a good solution is California, almond farmers moving here to grow filberts instead of water pig almonds." That's from Jay in Walterville, who likes to leave things a little open-ended for us. But I think he does raise an interesting point of you can't have food without water.
Well, and this is the key, as we've seen in the Central Valley of California over the last few years. I think the last thing I saw was 500,000 hectares completely laid fallow because they couldn't get enough water. And again, this is one of the great threats that climate change is bringing down the pipe. We currently use 70% of all our available fresh water just to feed ourselves, just for agriculture. And water demand, according to the United Nations, is expected to double by 2050, even though the UN admits we don't have water available to double that demand. So we're putting ourselves in an incredible pinch with water. Now, get on the better side, we also waste an enormous amount of water. Most irrigation in agriculture is only 50% efficient. So that means half of that Colorado River water coming down to Southern California is just either going up in the air or going down in the soil. And we've had very efficient methods of irrigation, gosh, since the Israelis developed it in the 1950s. micro-irrigation, drip irrigation. Some of it's coming off as very inexpensive that has a 90% efficiency. So, you know, we can certainly use water wiser, and we'll have to.
Has efficiency with water been incentivized properly? I mean, I don't know.
No, absolutely not. We're incentivized to waste it and not to. But I think as we start getting into an economic market for water, when you start seeing farmers in, you know, in Imperial Valley selling their water to San Diego for millions of dollars an acre foot, and there certainly then there becomes a water market, then farmers will start to realize that they can't waste it. And I've got a great example of this in the book in India, where in one part of India, in the Punjab, irrigation was subsidized. They gave them, you know, they built their pumps. There is an aquifer that they were pumping into. They gave them free electricity and told them to pump all they wanted. Well, they ran into great trouble with that. They pumped down the aquifer so far that it's no longer accessible to many farmers. But in another part of India, they tied the farmers' pumps into the commercial grid and put a meter on it and said, look, you're going to have to pay for any electricity you pump. And now they're using water very sparingly and very efficiently. So, you know, putting some of these things in place, taking away the subsidies that encourage waste, that's a no-brainer, too. You just have to do it.
Joel, we don't have a whole lot of time here. I have a question coming out of just straight curiosity. Now that you know all of this about food sourcing, you know, decades, really looking at the big picture here, how do you fare in restaurants?
Well, you know, we eat more and more in the restaurants now than we ever did. And this is one of the real ironies. We are so fascinated with our food these days, and yet we're cooking less. You know, we're getting to the point where we're so fascinating with it, we're going to lose our ability to produce it because we're so focused on chefs competing on television, which is really silly. But, when I go to restaurants, I always try to eat something low on the food web. Fish, lots of vegetables. I'm a pasta freak, so, you know, anything that's Italian with spaghetti or noodles in it, I'll love. And, of course, finding one that is farm to table is always nice because you know it's fresh.
So much to talk about with Joel K. Bourne, Jr., the author of The End of Plenty, The Race to Feed a Crowded World. We're out of time, though, so we'll just have to read his book. Thank you for being with us today, Joel.
Emily, it's been great.